Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Digital Leaders Podcast, Season 2, Episode 1. I'm Robin Knowles, and today I'm meeting Karen Dulver. Karen is co-founder and CEO at No Isolation. She's an entrepreneur and UX interaction designer. She has a startup experience from Startup Lab, a tech incubator in Oslo, and from co-founding a consultancy company, UX Lab, aiming to help companies with usability testing and interaction design. She's passionate about warm technology, more about that later, usability, design for good, and communication. Over the past few years, she's been listed as one of the top 50 women in tech by Forbes magazine and been featured by the BBC, Reuters, Financial Times, and Bloomberg, amongst others. And most impressively, she won the EU Commission Prize for Rising Innovator. So it's time to get on with the show and to meet Karen Dulver. Hello, Karen. Great to have you on the Digital Leaders Podcast today.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Before we find out a bit more about what you're doing at the moment, can you tell me a bit about growing up and some of the early inspirations that led you to who you are now?
Yeah, quite a big question. I've grown up in Norway with parents living an hour apart and going back and forth and back and forth, mostly being with my dad, actually, because my mom was working a lot when I was young. I think the inspiration behind No Isolation comes from a series of events. I think we've all felt this feeling of loneliness, and I've been in the startup industry for quite a few years. Started working in an incubator next to my studies at the University of Oslo, where, yeah, I was doing computer science, and I couldn't really understand why technology doesn't properly connect us and enable us to have those good conversations and feel like we're a part of a group.
So I think people would describe you as a technologist and an inventor. So are there inventors in your family? Where does that come from?
It actually is. My granddad was an inventor of several things, most of them very boring engineering stuff. Like, I think the most interesting might be a stone crushing machine, which he used to make like pebbles, and the Norwegian government bought a lot of them. So it was an actual proper machine. But then later in his life, after he got retired, crazy. He turned slightly crazy, and we ended up writing patents for a lot of ideas that he had been keeping through his entire life. And I don't know how many patent applications I've written for him on the computer, because he couldn't operate a computer himself and he wrote them by hand. And then I had to kind of type them in because he thought that the patent office was discriminating him due to age. And they could see that if he wrote like handwritten letters, but if I typed it up, then he was less likely to be discriminated against. Didn't really work, so we got none of them through. But still, I've written quite a few patent applications, at least.
So that must have been really helpful in kind of understanding the invention process, and I guess the legal invention process.
Or at least to get respect for it. But yeah.
So did you then go on to technology school? Did you study computers at university?
Yeah, but I didn't choose computer science due to him. That was actually a girlfriend of mine who mentioned it after I dropped out of economics studies, and she said you have to see what this is, Karen, and you have to get into the tech world because you'll love it. And she was completely right, and I've never looked back. But I had no idea what programming even was when I started the uni. I'm really happy I did.
And what was it you loved about it? Was it the logical process? I mean, you were studying economics, so presumably good at math, statistics, things like that.
Yeah, I've always kind of loved math, but then the economics side became more of the controlling the math instead of exploring it. And that's what technology really had. You could invent stuff and you could think and you could, I don't know, dream. And it was this whole new world where nothing was impossible. And I fell completely in love with the fact that nothing here is yet achieved. Like we've moved into a new era and we're barely at the beginning of it. And that's magical to me.
So what were your first steps in business? Did it start while you were at university, or did you go and get a job afterwards and then start thinking about running your own business?
No, I've worked since I was 14. I got my first like proper job at 16. I worked next to my studies all along, 40 and 50%. So I've always thought working was at least as fun as going to school. And I think the technology, like the sector I didn't move into until I started uni, where I got this part-time job at Startup Lab, a tech incubator. And that's where I fell in love with startups and got even more respect out of how to create a business as well, and how you could start with nothing but a couple of minds and create something. And that's, yeah.
And what was your first business then?
Well, I started something called UX Lab with four fellow students. We still hadn't finished our degrees, but what we wanted to do, we'd all seen this UX subject, which is user experience, and how all of the tech startups sitting in Startup Lab, they weren't really user testing the stuff that they were shipping out. They kept talking to their moms and their colleagues and asking people really close to them, how is this working? But you'll never get a perfect answer from your mom. Or maybe the wrong thing is that you will get the perfect answer. You won't get the honest answer. So the whole idea behind UX Lab as a company was to help startups and medium-sized companies to actually use or test and get the feedback that they needed to make their products and services better. And it was a lot of fun for quite a bit of time, but I don't know. I learned that you shouldn't start five people. That might be too many. And at least if your minds aren't like in the same place, and the dedication level we all had was very different, and we imagined something very different, all five of us, and it ended up being a mess, but a really, really steep learning curve. And yeah, I'd never be without that either, because you got a lot of respect for the work you have to put in to build a team and to have all the goals aligned. And yeah, it was a lot of learning.
I mean, that brings us on to this issue of being an entrepreneur. So what were I mean, you've talked about team building. What are the real challenges in your view of starting a business and being an entrepreneur? Is it money? Is it the sales side? Is it building a team? Is it all of that?
I think it's the sheer complexity that you can't really forget any of those things. So I think the finding funds, it's an okay task if that was the only thing you were doing. The building a company culture, that's an okay task if that's the only thing you're doing. And if your product is the only thing you're going to deliver on, then you'll deliver a perfect product as well. But I think the difficult part for me has been the complexity that it all has to fit together, and you have to set aside time for everything, and it has to be aligned, and everyone in the team kind of has to know their role in that whole puzzle. And that's the difficult part. I don't think any specific task has been the impossible one.
So tell me a little bit about No Isolation. So I know you're a co-founder to that. So was that someone you'd worked with before that you set
actually
up?
Actually not worked with. It was two other founders at Startup Lab. So we'd worked next to each other and kind of colleagues in that way, but not in the same company. And Marius and Matthias and I think we, all three of us, were, first of all, very aligned as to how to develop things. We wanted to do that from a user perspective and very much user-driven development, not sit there with our idea and think that this is genius, but really start with a problem and then try to find the solution and always be willing to sacrifice our own egos in the product development. And we were also very much aligned when it came to sales and how to think about this. We have to be out there and sell everything all the time, even though we find it highly uncomfortable. And we all come from tech and none of us really wanted to be that person, but then you have to. And I think Marius and I, at least, we knew that we were going to work together at some point in the future. No isolation just ended up being the trigger point for that. But if we weren't in a team now, then we would have been at some point later in life, I'm sure.
So I hesitate to say this, Karen, but not everybody listening to the Digital Leaders podcast is going to have heard of No Isolation. So tell us what you do and what it does.
So No Isolation should be its own name. We're working to eliminate social isolation and loneliness. And we're doing that by developing communication tools and services for groups that really needs it. And we've all seen this overwhelming amount of technology being targeted at the part of the population that are already efficient and making them more efficient. And we wanted to kind of find solutions for everyone that falls behind. And we started developing for children and teenagers suffering from long-term illness. And that kind of sprung out of this need to get them back to school and get them back to their friends. And we ended up building a telepresence robot for them. But now we've also started working with the senior population and seeing that 75% of those over 75 are not online at all, but their families are and their loved ones are. So we wanted to take the seniors online as well, but on their terms. So we've built a computer with only one button that we call Comp, and it connects the very oldest with everyone they care about through an app. So it's warm technology. It's not super suitable for a short pitch, but we haven't really focused on that. So we're making things we hope and think will be useful.
I've not heard that term warm technology before. So it sounds like warm technology is sort of super easy to use. Is that what warm technology is in your mind?
Warm technology in my mind is extremely, extremely focused on a specific user need. So for the kids, for example, using our telepresence robot, I don't think that would be super easy for anyone, but I think it's super easy for these kids because these kids are the ones we've been testing with and testing and testing and testing and testing. And we know that they get apps and they understand tablets, and we can use that to make something even more usable for them. But with the seniors, you needed to limit the amount of choices and possibilities of making mistakes. But no, for me, warm technology is something that actually helps and enables the person using it, and hopefully the people around them as well.
So would you describe this as tech for good?
Yeah. I think that's very suiting as well. It really is. And we're seeing more and more of the companies doing tech for good. And it cheers me up quite a lot. I think it's about time that we started making things that aren't just cool and started focusing on the actual issues.
Yeah, I agree. So who in the UK is using your tech at the moment? Do you sell it to individual people, or do you sell it into the education sector or the hospital sector? Kind of what's the market?
It's a bit different for the two products. For the AV1 robot, we're selling that primarily to schools and municipalities because it is their responsibility to get these kids back to school and let them be a part of the classroom environment. And then with Comp, we're selling that directly to the end customers, so the families. And the typical Comp customer is 45 to 65, and he or she has a mom or dad who's not using anything, and where they've tried iPads and they've tried Doro phones and nothing really works, that's where Calm fits in.
So taking the AV1 robot, which young people are using, I guess, first of all, give us a URL so people can go and have a look at it.
Yeah, noisolation.com. You'll see both AV1 and Calm.
And how are the kids using it? So it's a robot, but does the kid have it? Does the school have it? What's going on?
The school has it. The robot works exactly like an avatar in a game, hence the name AV1 as well. It's being remote controlled by the child who's unable to go. And typically we're talking about cancer patient, chronic fatigue, severe asthma, allergy, anxiety, quite a heavy diagnosis that keeps these kids from leaving their beds for often months, maybe even years at a time. And the robot goes out in the world on their behalf, and through it, the kids can see everything and talk to their friends and be a part of anything, really.
That sounds amazing.
Thank you.
So congratulations on that. I suppose on the data side, because it's, you know, everything's about data, just listening to you speak, I'm thinking, gosh, kids, hospitals, sort of privacy. So is that, did you guys get that on day one and know that it was going to be vital, or have you different countries different?
No, we really did get that this is going to be a huge issue for us day one. Realizing that we are going to put a camera in a classroom, I went to the Norwegian Authority on Privacy in Norway and tried to ask them out, like, what's allowed here? Where are the boundaries? Can you help me make something that will be okay? And they had obviously never heard of a telepresence robot going to school before. This was 3.5 years ago. And I ended up spending an hour and a half trying to explain to the local government how this was supposed to work. And all I had was this drawing that I've made on a piece of paper myself. And it was a bit of a nightmare. But then we hired in lawyers and try to understand, like, break down all of the privacy rules that are out there. And we ended up with something that really works, where we're sending all the video stream from the classroom through an end-to-end encrypted tunnel to the kid, and where everything is real time. So nothing is ever stored, which is what most of the privacy laws are regarding storing. Where is it stored and is it safe? And access, who has access to this, and could it be spread? But we're giving the kid who is supposed to be there anyways access, and only this child. And that kind of surpasses everything, because they also have a right to be there, and we're leveraging that. But yeah, no, when the GDPR came, we were kind of okay. we had to make some new documentation of what we were doing, but we were, quite good, which was a really good feeling. And now we're seeing that each country they have their specific laws, but what we really need to do is not change the product, just add documentation and add evidence of what's being done and how things are being processed. It's been super important, because it's the only way our product will work, is if governmental, like, institutions actually say that this is okay.
Brilliant. So I can't really have this conversation with you without talking about the fact that you're an inspirational woman in tech.
Oh, stop it.
But that, I mean, that has been positive in terms of profile and raising awareness of you and therefore your business and your the work that you're doing. But it also brings with it kind of huge responsibility and an opportunity, because there's a lot of role modeling sort of conversations going on about, you know, kind of people can see it, they believe they can be it. Do you want to say a little bit about that sort of gender diversity issue in tech, your, maybe the journey you've been on, and what you think we should be doing more of to improve the situation?
Yeah, no, I think for me personally, it's been a bit of a shock how much attention it has given just the fact that I'm not a man. and of course there's massive upsides to that, where you're actually getting recognition maybe earlier than most other startups would. But it's also a downside that attention is costing you time, and it's quite an effort, and you have to we at least had to be careful from day one that our message was on point and that we're doing all the right things, where we could have maybe hidden away for at least a year or two and said that, okay, now we're working on our own thing for a bit first. But that didn't really happen because the Norwegian tech scene was starved. Less than 1% of the VC-funded companies in Norway are funded by females. So when someone comes along and says that, okay, I'm going to start a tech company and it's going to be a high-tech company and we're going to build robots for kids, you're automatically very easy to write about, especially when you're a female. So no, it has been up and downs. I had no idea how much it was going to be. And I'm really lucky to have colleagues that are helping me out with everything. So I'm not alone in this, luckily.
And what, I mean, I don't know how involved you've got in the UK women in tech scene, but I mean, you've talked about sort of being singled out as an exemplar, but that takes time to go out and talk to people. Are people doing the right things? I assume we need to do more of everything, but what's your focus when it comes to encouraging more women into tech?
Specifically kids. Here in the UK, women in tech scene, I haven't been very active at all, but I'm also seeing that there's not the same pool here. You have a more diverse pool to kind of take from, which is a huge relief for me. I find that really, really good. And in Norway, I'm a part of several kind of communities where we're teaching kids to code. And it's been quite amazing. And I think my focus would always be there on the education bit and how to get especially girls into the STEM subjects and seeing how you can talk about technology in a not so boring and technical way. There's this creative side to technology that is not reserved for the designers alone. It's for everyone creating solutions.
What would you say to women? I suppose women in tech is a massive topic, isn't it? So there's sort of exemplars like yourself, but then there's just people doing a day job in a tech team or in a tech related team. How do they encourage the next generation to get involved?
Well, they're massively important and I think often forgotten or underestimated. It was a friend of mine who got me into technology, and she's not famous or anything. I don't think she would consider herself a role model, but she definitely is. And taking care of the girls who are already in the industry and making sure that they thrive, that will ensure that more girls comes along. Because when it comes to choosing what to pick for your uni degree, then you need people around you who can actually talk about how they experienced that degree. And so far, we've got too few girls, but let's take care of the heroes that we do have. And I think that might be more important than just raising a few people up, because this life that I am living is definitely not something that everyone would want.
You sort of hinted there about the lifestyle of being an entrepreneur, and I don't know whether there are specific challenges for women. You said not everybody would like your lifestyle, and I suspect that isn't necessarily gender specific, as I'm sure you're incredibly busy. But just maybe reflect on that. What is your typical week, and what barriers does that put in the way to other things you might want to do?
Well, I think the problem might be that a typical week doesn't exist. It's been 3 years of different weeks, really. And I'm traveling quite a lot, which I thought would be amazing before I began. And then you start living out of a tiny suitcase that you can fit in as hand luggage. And then you realize that this isn't a dream at all. This is something quite different. And I've kind of dedicated myself to this company and the cause that we're at. And I fully understand why everyone and anyone wouldn't want to do that, because there are so many things to life. I'm lucky to have a boyfriend who also loves working in, where we've kind of found this way to fit it all into our lives. But it's it is a lifestyle that I'm sure isn't for everyone.
And how do you reflect that kind of in your company? Because I know you've got a very gender diverse company as well. So do you have policies that kind of make allowances? Yeah.
We have quite a few policies, actually, where I don't want people to work until they drop at all. So we're quite strict on the 8 hours of working. Unless there's a huge deadline or something very specific coming up, then I strongly encourage people to leave when they're done for the day. We've also ended up paying for more than double the maternity leave for our colleagues in the Netherlands, where we were seeing that, okay, 1 month away from work paid by the government, that's not nearly enough. And I wouldn't want anyone to come back to work before they're ready. So we're kind of taking measures where we can to ensure that it's possible to have a full and really good life next to no isolation, because working all day around, that's my choice, and I started this, but it shouldn't be the job of everyone else to do the same.
And in terms of external forces, I guess the main one is going to be your investors. So it sounds like you found investors who kind of buy into that set of values. I mean, have you come across other founders or people where the investors kind of make it difficult for them to, set up schemes and programs and encourage behaviors that just aren't all about the bottom line?
Yeah, no, I've heard these stories of investors being the evil guys who pushes you to the very edge. but I haven't really experienced it myself. And none of my friends from Startup Lab has any stories from their own lives as well. But you hear them coming up again and again. So you're very aware when meeting investors that, okay, I'm gonna think about this and I'm gonna be very upfront about how I am running no isolation. So there's no confusion there. But I don't know. None of the people I've met, or at least none of the people who've ended up investing, has had that agenda. And I think everyone investing in a company like ours, where there is no quick exit, we're not making this one algorithm that can be easily sold. We're building a company, and you have to invest in a long-term plan and a journey. And when you're investing in a long-term plan, you also have to take care of the people who are supposed to execute on that plan. So I think we've gotten really overwhelmingly positive feedback on how we're running the company culture.
I really get that strong impression from what you're saying. So obviously this is the Digital Leaders podcast, so I have to ask you about leadership. You're interacting with leaders all the time that run hospitals, councils, schools. How important is it that they understand the digital world?
Extremely important. I've I've met quite a few levels of people who are not happy with incorporating technology in their everyday life. I think there's quite a few that have almost been traumatized by huge systems being implemented and not being good enough to actually being used yet. You come and you try to bring some technology optimism into the room, which has always been my role. So I'm very pro and trying to talk about the good things. And I think I have one specific example where leadership hasn't been taking all the way, where we started working with a hospital in Norway way in the beginning, and the management, upper management, was really stoked to have us there and wanted to have a partnership with us. And we were thrilled, of course. We wanted to work with this hospital. But then we showed up the next week and the nurses haven't even been told that we were coming. And they were definitely not pro-tech at all. They didn't want the solution, and they didn't want us to talk to the kids that they were working with. And that's where leadership should step in and teach and take care of everyone in the organization, so they don't feel like they're being forced into using new solutions, but that they can be a part of that journey instead. So I've been disappointed a couple of times, and then I've been very happy other times where you're here in Britain, the educational department bought 90 robots off of us to test in 10 different places in the UK for 2 years, which is amazing. And I think that's really showing by doing and getting some good examples out there.
Well, congratulations with that. Okay, Karen, well, we're very nearly finished now, sadly. So let's finish on a quick fire round. I've got three questions for you. So what one book would you recommend to our listeners and why?
I have to say several books, but all by the same writer. P.G. Wodehouse has been with me since I was a teenager, and my dad keeps discovering new books about Jeeves, and I swallow them whole. They're amazing.
That's interesting. So my tidbit for you will be that P.G. Wodehouse's original study and typewriter are on display in the library at Dulwich College.
Really?
In South London. So that sounds like a visit one weekend when you're here in the UK.
No, maybe even this afternoon. That's right. Thank you. That's really cool.
Okay, our second question is, who is the one person you would love to have lunch with and why?
Can I choose someone who is past, or do I have to choose someone I could actually end up having lunch with?
No, people who are no longer with us, they qualify.
They qualify. Then Elizabeth I or her dad, Henry VIII, definitely.
You're going to have to tell us why.
I have just, when good books go, I've just read about Henry VIII again. And well into that, I had to put it away because I started thinking about Elizabeth I and how it must have been like taking over the throne as a woman in 1550, which is incredible. And after having read anything I could get my hands on about her, I'm so fascinated. I don't even know where to begin. She chose not to marry, not to have kids, and it was probably the smartest choice anyone has ever made. I'm really impressed by how she ran the country. Deaths went down, wars went down, economy went up. It was the golden age in every aspect, which is amazing.
Fantastic. I wasn't expecting you to say that. Okay. And my last question in the quickfire round is, tell us one thing about yourself that our listeners may be surprised to learn about you.
Oh, good question. I bought my first car when I was 12. It was a complete wreck. And I kept it at my grandfather's farm where I drove it around as fast as I absolutely could. He had a huge field and he would make these tracks for me where I could drive. And I really wanted to be a rally driver when I grew up, but it didn't end up that way, unfortunately.
Those are three great answers.
Thank you.
And told us a lot about you as well, just in that quick fair round, I think. So, wow, sadly, Karen, it is time to bring things to a close. So thank you so much for being on the Digital Leaders podcast today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That is it for this episode of the Digital Leaders podcast. Now, of course, we would love to know your thoughts. Tag us at DigiLeaders and let us know. And if you want to find out more about today's guest, head on over to our website, digileaders.com/podcast, and we have all that information there. That is it for this week. I'm your host, Robin Knowles. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Digital Leaders Podcast.